I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn. He's joined in conversation by novelist and essayist Ayelet Waldman. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Daniel Mendelsohn and Ayelet Waldman.
Daniel Mendelsohn is here this evening, an award-winning author, critic, translator, and frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and The New Yorker. His books include The Elusive Embrace, the international bestseller The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the National Jewish Book Award, among many other honors. 2 essay collections, How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken, and Waiting for the Barbarians, and a 2-volume translation of the complete poems of Constantine Cavafy. Daniel also happens to be one of my all-time favorite Arts and Ideas guests, so I'm personally delighted to have him back on our stage, and especially on the occasion of the publication of his wonderful new book, An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic, which the New York Times calls, quote, revealing and funny. Mendelsohn makes Homer's epic shine in your mind. Appearing in conversation with Daniel this evening is our friend Ayelet Waldman, who we're always so happy to have at the JCC. Ayelet's most recent books include A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life, and Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. Please join me in giving them a warm welcome to the JCC.
Hey, sweetie. So we're going to confess something right from the get-go. I have not read The Odyssey. I tried 3 separate times. I couldn't read it. And yet I am interviewing Daniel. And the reason that I am interviewing Daniel has something to do with the fact with the way we met, which I'm just going to tell that story before we go on.
Okay.
So this is how we met. We had lunch. Daniel and my husband and I, we had never met before. We sat and had lunch in New York City. After the NBCC, after this award night. And halfway through the lunch, I invited Daniel to come to Italy with our family. We were going for a month, and I invited him to come for 2 weeks with us while we were in Italy renting this. We did a house swap in Umbria. And he said yes. And it wasn't until he was on the plane coming over, and we knew he was on the plane, that I had the thought, oh my God, we don't know this person from Adam. And he had the thought, oh my God, I don't know these people at all, but we're going to spend 2 weeks in a foreign country together. And the reason was because he's so incredibly charming and easy to talk to that it took basically the appetizer course for me to realize that I wanted to spend more time with him. So I'll even talk about this book that makes me so frightened, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that too. So here we go. This is a book about the time your dad took your freshman seminar on the Odyssey at Bard College. Daniel is a professor of classics at Bard College. So my first question is, what in God's name were you thinking?
Well, so what happened was, it was January 2011. I was going to be teaching this seminar. Every now and then I do a course at Bard, where Michael and Ayelet's son is now a student, which is very nice for me. We go have the all-you-can-eat Indian on Tuesday nights. Every now and then I do a course about one text, which is basically teaching freshmen how to read literature. So we only look at one text and we spend the whole semester. So you need a big text. And sometimes you do the Iliad, sometimes I do the Odyssey. So I was doing this Odyssey course, and the semester starts January 30th or something like that. And right after New Year's, my dad called. And he said, what are you doing this semester? And I said, I'm doing the Odyssey. He said, I'll take that. So I had two reactions. This is the most fun event I'm going to do on this book tour, which started in September and finishes in December, because you're the only person who I'm doing a thing like this with who actually knew my father, which is much, it's just very special for me. And in fact, you saw him for the last time. Yeah. When he was coming home from the Bay Area, where he had what turned out to be his fatal fall. So I had two reactions. My father, I should say, was a scientist. He was a mathematician and spent his whole career working as a research scientist or as an aerospace corporation. And he was a very well-read person. He was not a literature person. I mean, he was extremely well-read, but he was a science guy. But I knew that he, in high school in the Bronx, had been a big Latin scholar. He was very well in Latin. As some of you may know this, many mathematicians, there's a high correlation between ability at math and ability in Latin. And so my father was this math genius in high school, but he was also good in Latin. And for reasons which you discover in the book, he gave up studying Latin, much to the disgruntlement of his teacher. And I think, so I sort of had this idea that he wanted to do it because he wanted to have one last go at the classics. And I have to say, I was very touched when he asked to sit in. Now, this is a freshman seminar. So it's not only college students, but it's first-year college students. They're 17-year-old kids. My father was 81. And I thought it was very typical of him. My father grew up, had a pretty hard-scrabble childhood in the Bronx during the Depression. His parents were lovely people, but they were not educated people. They were not readers, particularly. My father, as he loved to tell this story, when he was in seventh grade, was misdiagnosed with rheumatic fever, and they made him stay home for 6 months, and there was nothing to do but read, and that's when he became a reader. And everything that he knew, he was, in many ways, he was self-educated, because everything he knew came out of books. And so I was touched, and it seemed to me very typical of him, that at the age of 81, he would decide he wants to sit with a bunch of freshmen and study Homer's Odyssey. That said, yeah. I was a little nervous because, as you also know, my sister-in-law is here tonight also, and she can corroborate this. You did never want to be in an argument with my father. He was like a dog with a bone, you know. And I was a little nervous about how it was going to actually pan out. Right. Because he said, so we'd had a talk, and I said, well, you're going to, so this is a class that met once a week, Fridays, for almost 3 hours. It was a seminar. A bunch of kids sitting around a big square table talking about the text. It wasn't a lecture. It was very intimate, very hands-on. And I said, you know, are you gonna like do the homework? How much do you really do you want to do? And he said, no, I'll just sit in the back. I won't say a word.
So, like, but
that lasted
talk
five
about where he
minutes.
Sat, because I feel like he picked a seat. It was almost like he was your psychoanalyst.
Oh, no, it was totally passive aggressive. So you have to imagine a big rectangular wooden seminar table that fits 14 people. And my dad never sat at the table. There were some extra chairs in the room, and he always pulled up a chair behind me and to my left. So I always, to acknowledge him when he talked, which he started doing 5 minutes into the first day of class, I would have to turn my whole body around. So it was a big kind of power play. But it was actually funny, because when you're teaching, particularly when you're teaching first-year students, you know, it's a lot of work that goes into creating a kind of pedagogical dynamic, right? Sometimes it's their first literature course that they ever took, and they're in college, and they're a little overwhelmed by the fact that this is a college course, and blah, blah, blah. On top of that, it's Homer. You know, there's right. a lot of genuflecting going on psychologically, and so you have to, as a professor, you need to work to establish, you know, you don't want to be too familiar, but right. you want to give them some space. You also have to simultaneously establish your authority, whatever. So normally when you are a college professor teaching a freshman class, you are the oldest person in the room. And you are also the most authoritative person
right.
in the room.
And that's like and a shortcut suddenly, to authority, right?
Right. Suddenly, there's this older person who for them was more authoritative because he was the father. You know, it's funny, but it's also true. So it created.
You describe this, how sometimes they would like look at you, like look at him, you know, to see whether like what the right response.
Yeah,
was.
I'm asking questions about Bronze Age epic, and they're looking at my father, who's a mathematician. And so it created this. It, you know, it's funny, but it was also very productive in a funny way because it created this kind of double vision, this sort of stereoscopic vision in the classroom where I had to think for the first time about exactly what I thought I was doing,
right.
you know, as a teacher. And the real payoff, I guess, of all this was that, and this sort of ongoing joke of the book, my father hated the Odyssey. And he hated Odysseus. And that becomes a kind of a running... It's both a joke and not a joke. Because
I'm so with him, by the way. That's why I can never finish this book. And I, well, like the same reasons, too. Like you talk about how he hated Odysseus because he thought he was like a crybaby and because he could never do anything on his own. He's always having Athena drop in and fix things for him.
Right.
So describe some of like the way that he would.
Well, you know, it was interesting because. So the semester is 14 weeks. We did two books at a time. It's 24 books, a little bit of padding. And so we were able to talk about the text in fairly deep detail. You know, you've got 3 hours to talk about two books of the poem. And it was interesting because, so it's the first day of class. So this is about my dad's objections. It's the first day of class. And I'm into my, so normally it's a free-ranging conversation where I'm just trying to sort of manage the conversation and let them participate. But on the first day of class, you have to do a spiel. You know, you have to do an introduction. But so I'm 5 minutes into my introductory spiel, and I hear my father grunt. He says, I don't think he's such a hero. And I'm like, Dad, you know. And he said, and this became the sort of leitmotif, right? He said, well, you know, he cries. He gets help from the gods. He cheats on his wife. He lies. He makes stuff up. What's so great about that? You know, and that was day one. You know, and so, but it was interesting to, you know, come back to your point, right? Because the objections that he had to the character of Odysseus are, in fact, things that scholars have been talking about for 25 centuries. You know, he is not a straightforward hero, right? He is famously, so of the two great Greek epics, the Iliad, of whom the hero is Achilles, and the Odyssey, of whom the hero is Odysseus. And Achilles is all brawn and military prowess and, you know, courage. And Odysseus is a hero of the mind. He gets out of tricky situations by lying, by telling tall tales, by punning, by tricking people. Look, he came up with the idea of the Trojan horse, the greatest trick of all, right? So, and that bothered my father. So it's very interesting. Anyone who has been in a book club knows about this, that people's response to the book will often tell you more about them than it tells you about the book.
Right.
Right? And this was happening to me in my own classroom in a way that, you know, I'm being funny now, but it was actually often very touching. My father literally couldn't understand. My father was a mathematician. He wanted the world to be an equation, you know, where everything matched up perfectly. And why you would want to heroize a character who's a cheat and a liar and a trickster was literally beyond him. And I was so touched by that because it just said something about him. You know, he just couldn't understand why anyone thought this guy was so great. Also, I should say, if you've read my book, The Lost.
I was just about to say that.
Okay, so in The Lost, a big hero of The Lost is my grandfather, my mother's father, who was exactly an Odysseus type. And I talk a lot about him in that book. And so, of course, I also realized that the reason he didn't like Odysseus is because he reminded him of his father-in-law. That really hit me one day. I was like, oh, that's why you can't say. Or maybe it's a chicken and an egg.
Right, right. Right.
Maybe he didn't like my grandfather because he was an Odysseus character.
So, like, what are some of the other insights you gained into his character by the way he responded to the material, by the way? Like, you know, I mean, such an amazing thought that I never thought of that in terms of teaching, that how a student responds, and in this case your father, to the material tells you everything about who they are.
Oh, well, totally. And in fact, there was one student in this class, this kid, Brendan, who's an L.A. kid, I remember, and he you always do this when you teach. Of course the things that they say, all of our responses to literary texts are ultimately personal.
Right.
If you're a critic for a living, as I am, you dress it up in ironclad arguments, but it always comes down to temperament and taste. Right,
right.
So everyone's always reacting personally, even when they're pretending that it's an absolute truth, right? And, you know, so this kid always had the most piercing insights about the relationship, which is a big part of the Odyssey, between Odysseus and his son. Mm-hmm. So as I'm sure many of you know, Odysseus goes off to the Trojan War. The war takes 10 years, and it takes him 10 years to get home. He had left this infant child. Now he's a 20-year-old guy, and they have to know each other. And this kid, every time he talked about that relationship, had such a cute insight. So, like, a big part of the relationship is when they first meet the grown son and now this middle-aged father whom he never knew, it's very uncomfortable between them. And he keeps wobbling. He wishes the father would come home. Then he's home. He doesn't know how to deal with it. And this kid said in class one day, he said, well, maybe he's so ambivalent about it because it's easier if the father is dead and he doesn't have to get to know him. And, of course, I thought, what's his relationship with his father like?
Right, right.
You know, and in fact, I had actually more about this in the book and I ended up cutting it. It just sort of became its own thing, but I actually was pretty close to this kid, and he had told me at the beginning of class that one of the reasons he wanted to take the Odyssey is he was finally getting very close to his father, because I had sent out an email saying my father is going to be part of the class, and he said that's one of the reasons he took the class, because he was interested in this father-son stuff, and it was so obvious because he was so alert to this dynamic in the poem. Right, but we all do that.
But was
right?
your dad alert to that dynamic? Like, did your father see that dynamic and the two of your relationship?
Yes, and in fact, one of the most devastating conversations we had was discussing this very important passage in Book 16 where the grown son is finally reunited with the father. And the kids always find this a very difficult scene because, you know, if it were a TV movie today, they would rush into each other's arms with sweeping symphonic music and tears. But Homer is much smarter than Hollywood, and it's a very awkward moment. And the kid rejects him, and he says, this can't be right. You can't be my father, which is so psychologically true, because if you've been dreaming about your absent father your whole life, of course he's going to be so wonderful, and then any reality is going to be a disappointment. And Homer gets that, and he creates this great moment where the kid pushes him away, and he's like, this can't be right. You can't be this person I've been thinking of. So I was talking about this. So my dad would come up on Thursday afternoons. First, he would drive up. It's like a three-hour drive from Long Island up to Bard. And then he started taking the train for reasons I only later discovered. And we were talking about this, and there's this wonderful part of this scene where Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, he meets his father in the tent of a servant who lives on the outskirts of town, who he is very close to because he's grown up without a father, and you get a sense that this old servant is the one who has really been the father for him. And as you know, there's this scene in my book. So I was not close to my father for the first half of my life and was very awkward around him. And I had a series of kind of substitute parent father figures when I was growing up, high school teachers, whatever. I was also a gay adolescent, and I was always finding these gay, you know, choir teachers or whatever. Now, all consulting their lawyers.
You're listening to writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn, whose new memoir is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. He's joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so I was talking to my dad. So he would come up on Thursday, and we would go to the same restaurant every Thursday night. We would sleep over my house because the course was Friday morning, first thing in the morning. And so we're having dinner that night, and we're talking about this very passage. And he said, not looking at me at one point, he said, oh, I like this part. So I was always so happy if he liked something,
right.
You know. And he said, I like that part because what happens is in the moment just before Odysseus is reunited with his son, the three of them are in this hut together, the servant, the son, and Odysseus. And the son walks in, and of course, Odysseus is in disguise. He doesn't recognize him, and he throws himself into the arms of the servant, and they hug and they kiss. And my father said to me, it must have been so hard for him to see his own son so close to this other guy.
And do you think he was talking about that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was he? Like, who was he thinking about? Sort of all the range.
Yeah.
Of?
Yeah. So I think he did.
And what did you say? Did you just sweep under the rug, or did you pretend you were talking about Odysseus for the rest of the dinner? What did you do?
No, we talked. I was very close to my dad. You know, at the end of his life, we traveled a lot together. This was our last great adventure, because we haven't even gotten to the cruise.
Yes.
But this was our last adventure. But no, we talked about this stuff. At that point, we talked about that. But I was very awkward around my father when I was growing up. And, you know, a lot of what the book is about, and what the Odyssey really understands, which I never thought of before because I never had my father in the classroom, is how little children understands their parents, and particularly their parents' marriage. I would say a lot of the Odyssey is about this kid. And now Odysseus comes home. He has to be reunited with the son, but he also famously is reunited with his long-suffering wife, Penelope. And the kid doesn't understand why the parents aren't acting the way he wants them to
right,
act.
Right.
And I thought, God, this poet was so smart, because you don't ever really understand your parents' marriage.
That moment where he says that thing about your mother, talk about that and the effect that had on the class.
So at the end of the Odyssey, he makes it back home. He has to infiltrate his palace in disguise. He kills all these poor guys who are trying to marry his wife. And finally, there's this famous recognition scene between Odysseus and Penelope. And of course, one of the other things the Odyssey is so smart about is time, you know. We change with time. And so the question that it poses is, how is this couple going to recognize each other? You know, they were 19, now they're 40, and anyone who's gone to a high school reunion knows what this is like. And of course, the thing that finally does allow them to recognize each other is not some physical token or sign or appearance, but a secret that they share, and only the two of them share, and that's what finally allows them to say, aha, it's really you. And we were talking about this in class, and it's May, we're at the end of the semester, and it's such a great moment in the Odyssey, this amazing moment. And again, it's about the psychological truth of a long-awaited reunion. It's not the way you want it to be, because he comes back, he kills the suitors, he takes off his disguise, and he's like, honey, it's me. And she's like, whoa, not so fast, right? And the kids are always so disappointed. They're like, why does she wait? It's obviously him, blah, 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 blah. And it's hard for them to imagine. You know, these are 17-year-old kids. Odysseus and Penelope have been separated for 20 years. Their whole lives haven't even been 20 years. They can't even imagine the emotional impact of this moment. So I was having a very hard time in class that day. And I said to them, think what it's like. You know, you want to believe it's them, but you have to be sure before you let the floodgates open. And the whole thing was not going down well. And my father suddenly spoke up. But in one of these really, I mean, our father was very crusty at a certain level, but was actually a very sweet person in many ways. And he suddenly said, I know what it is like. He said, I can tell you what it is like to be with someone so long that on the outside they have no resemblance to the person you started out with. And that's what the whole Odyssey is about. How do you know who someone is, right? Is there an inner core that never changes? And we all think about this at every stage of life, and particularly as you get older. Is there a you that transcends time and, you know, suffering and all these things? And he started talking about my mother in class, and the kids were just open mouthed. I never heard him talk about my mother like that. Hey, I'm not even joking now. He said his mother was so beautiful when I met her in 1946. And he started reminiscing, and I was just open mouthed, you know. So I think there was something in the text, as much as he didn't like it, that spoke to him, and that I thought, this is what you always want to have happen when you're trying to teach someone about a book that you really love and you want them to get it.
Right.
And it can be so frustrating when it doesn't, you know. And I thought that he got, you know, he got the most important part of the Odyssey, which is how obsessed it is with this question of identity. Mm-hmm. Who are you? And especially in a couple.
Right.
Does a husband and a wife share something so profound that even if they become physically unrecognizable to each other, is it still there? Which is just another way about saying it's a relationship.
I like the, your mother's so hilarious. So, you know, Bed, Death, and Beyond is...
Death, Bed, and Beyond.
Yeah. Bed, Bath, and Beyond, but of which she calls Death, Bed, and Beyond.
My mother's famous for her malapropism. So.
But there's that wonderful thing you describe of her, what she would do anytime, whenever he came home from work when you were kids, she would stand at the top of the stairs, right?
Yeah.
And he would pass her by, and then what would she say?
So the fact that my father was so undemonstrative became like an active joke in my family, even when we were growing up. So he would come home from work. She would stand at the top of the stairs. He would clump up the stairs, walk right by her. And she would say, Jay, not in front of the children. No. Well, she had this joke. So she had been a school teacher in the New York City school system when they were newlyweds. And then she had all of us. And then she went back to teaching in her 50s and 60s, and she had this joke where she would say to her colleagues in the lunchroom, she said, is today Wednesday? I have to know if it's Wednesday. And they would say, why? She said, because on Wednesday, Jay lets me kiss him. Yeah. So that was really a great moment, and it was a kind of culminating moment, and I liked, it's also a kind of climax of the book,
right,
too, because... Again, you think you've figured out your parents' marriage, and it turns out you don't know anything.
I also want to talk about the trip, because the book really has these two parts, and one of them is this cruise you go on, this Odyssey cruise. And you write about so beautifully about the transformative power of travel and how, in a way, that's also one of the major themes of the Odyssey. And so your dad on this trip, you see this side of him you've never seen before. So tell us a little bit about like the Jay Mendelsohn who suddenly appeared in the cabaret of the of the cruise ship.
Well, it was interesting. So at the end, just as the semester was ending, I got a call from my friend Froma, whom some of you will remember from The Lost. She's a recurring character. She's like Betty White. In my memoirs, she's a recurring character, and she was my dissertation advisor when I was doing my PhD in classics, and all through the semester, she had been calling to find out how it was going, teaching my father, you know, it was so funny. And so just at the end of the semester, she said, you know, I can't believe I forgot to tell you, there's this cruise that recreates the voyages of Odysseus. She said, George and I went on it 4 years ago. And she said, you have to go. So I called my dad, never thinking he was going to do this because he hated to spend money. and he not only wanted to go on it, but he said, I want you to get the nicest cabin. I want a balcony. I want a So we went on the cruise. And the great thing about that was, well, there were many great things about that. It was actually on the cruise when I thought I was going to write a book.
You know, I was going to ask you that because I don't believe you. I think that when he said, I'm going to sit in your class, some part of you must have been saying, I can get material.
Oh, no, I knew it was material. In fact, I called my editor, Leo Carey, at The New Yorker, and I said, you know, my dad's going to be taking my undergraduate Odyssey seminar, and I think there's going to be some great piece, you know. But it was on the cruise that I thought is way too much for a New Yorker personal history piece. So we went on the cruise. And as you know, many amazing, you know, because you have to think, who goes on an Odyssey cruise? And I can tell you, it's a lot of 50-year-olds with their elderly parents. And actually all kinds of people, and they were wonderful, and it was interesting. This was a serious thing. This was not like all-you-can-eat shrimp, you know. It was, there was a reading list. Every day you were at a different site. You were schlepping around the site with the archaeologist who was excavating the site. It wasn't just some person waving a pink umbrella. You know, it was serious stuff. So people who signed up are already serious. So I had these amazing things happen. And but for our purposes... So, yes, there are these two major parts, the classroom, the cruise, and then the hospital. Mm-hmm. And obviously part of what the Odyssey is about is the adventures that you have if you leave home and how transformative they are. One of the reasons Odysseus is not recognizable to his wife when he gets home is he's had so many experiences, he's become a different person. We know that about travel. That's why you send your kid abroad on their junior year, right? It enhances you. It transforms you. And it happened to my father in front of my eyes on this thing. I think, you know, my father was, to say the least, not a relaxed person for a lot. Well, I mean, in some ways, he was very typically a man of his generation. He was an American breadwinner of his generation.
Right.
He was born a week before the stock market crashed. His adolescence was spent during World War II, and that formed him. So he went to work, he put us through school, you know, he did all that stuff. And on the cruise, I'd like to think that he relaxed into a version of himself that could have been him if there had been no depression, you know, if there had been no World War II. You know, he was affable, he was genial, he was telling, so everyone loved him. You know, it was so funny. And I thought, you know, my father was a great guy and very charming in many ways. But I wouldn't, if you asked me, if you stopped me in the street and said, oh, was your father a suave and charming person? I would say no.
Well, you know? I mean, that's sort of interesting because, like, did he take that? Like, you're a very, I mean, you're a person who people invite to go to Italy when they've only had lunch with you or not even through lunch. So suave and charming is exactly the way I would describe you. Did he fill that spot or could you, was there enough room for sort of the double Mendelsohn, you know?
Well,
could you be a suave and charming Daniel as he was a suave and charming Jay?
I mean, ultimately, you know, he was a great person and he had so much to say and he was, but he, you know, my mother liked to say he was a diamond in the rough, you know, he had no like party skills, you know, I mean, he would like, I remember once my agent came to visit my parents' house to break fast and she's the daughter of a very famous journalist, Gary Wills, who's a very devout Catholic. And he's driving her from the train station to the breakfast, and he goes on one of his atheistic rants against religion. And I'm like, Dad, did you even pause to consider whether she might believe any of this? You know, so that was my father, you know. But he was a kind of a darling guy. Just, he didn't have a lot of social skills necessarily. But on this cruise, it was like being, it's like, I remember when I was growing up watching Dark Shadows, there was like if you walk through a certain door, you were in a parallel universe. It was like being in a parallel universe. Every night, there was a group of people who met at the lounge, the piano bar, and my father became like the king of the piano bar. And he would, in these, you know, club chairs, having his martini, reminiscing about his childhood, the first day, the opening day of The Wizard of Oz in 1939 and Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney coming up through the floor with an organ playing and all this stuff and singing songs, Rodgers and Hart songs and whatever. So I think it was interesting because what was happening on the cruise was what happens in the Odyssey, which is this guy was being transformed. And I think just being so relaxed, he was very proud of himself for having, as he thought, mastered the Odyssey. You know, that meant a lot to him that he had stuck with it. He came every week. He thought he knew something about Homer.
Right, right.
And so he was just so proud and so happy. And I thought, you know, who knows if certain things had been different in life. He like, I never saw him like that when I was growing up, but he could have been that way. And I thought that was very touching. And, it, you know, a few months later, we were here in the Bay Area having a family reunion, and he tripped in a parking lot, and he fell, and that was the beginning of the end. So it turned out to be his last adventure.
Right.
And I'm so happy we had that, you know.
I mean, it's so interesting because your mom hates to travel, and so they never traveled. And I, when I was reading it, I wondered, like, was that a side of him that just never flourished because it never had the opportunity?
Yeah.
And it might have, if they had started cruising, you know, when they were in their 30s.
And
or
he
40s.
Wanted to.
Yeah.
My mother just doesn't like to travel. And so being the kind of couple they were of the generation that they were, he didn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It was inconceivable that she would stay home and he would go someplace without her. But I started taking him everywhere when I was, you know, when I started to do a lot of foreign book tours and international literary festival, you know, all this stuff that we do. And I would say about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years before he died, starting in the mid-2000s, 2005, something like that, I just took him everywhere. And he was just like a kid in a toy shop. He was so happy. And that's, you know, when this transformation started. I remember in Paris.
I've noticed that you like to travel with, like, you like to bring one elderly relative with you on every journey. Like, your Facebook page, I'm like, what old aunt does he have this time?
It's true. I was in Norway last week with an aunt of mine who happens to be Norwegian-American. But I was at a party in Paris. Friends of mine in Paris had a book party for me 7 or 8 years ago, and my father was there. My father was so happy to be in Paris, his entire idea of which was formed from that movie about Toulouse-Lautrec with what's his name, Jose Ferrer. And we were at this very elegant Parisian soiree, and all these women kept coming up to me and saying, oh, your father, he's so charming. And I was like, who are they talking about? I don't even. So that was great. I'm glad we had that. And it makes you think, though, about life, right? And it's a very Greek thought. One of the reasons I love Greeks, the Greeks, and their literature is they are not sentimental about the fact that every action has consequences that are inescapable. That's basically what every Greek tragedy is about. You make a choice, it's going to come back to you, even if you think it's not.
Mm.
And he made his choices and had the life he had. But somehow being on this cruise and also having had these travels, which I don't write about in the book, it's like I got a glimpse into a parallel life that he could have had that allowed a part of his personality to come out that didn't get a lot of play, you know.
It's so wonderful that you had a chance to do that.
It was.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn, whose new memoir is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. He's joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So let's open to questions for a little while.
How did this trip perhaps change you?
How did the trip change me? Well, I mean, it's certainly, that's so interesting. No one has asked me that question in 2 months of book tour. Well, I think, as I said, I was already close to my dad by the time we went on the trip, but I did see, I did have insights, I think, into him that I would never have had, and that, I think, deepened my appreciation of him. I've been to all these places before, so it didn't, I wasn't seeing anything new in terms of just the tourism, so to speak, but look, it's a very transformative thing if you get a chance in your life to see your parent as other than your parent, see your parent through the eyes of other people, which we almost never get to do. Our parents are these figures from us from the minute we're born, and that's how you think about them. And then suddenly to be given this kind of angle, like to see the passengers on the cruise reacting to my father and seeing things in him that I didn't see just because that's not the way I look at him was so amazing. I felt I got so much out of that. And because he, as it turned out, didn't have that much longer after all this stuff happened, you know, I felt like, and we had some great moments, just the two of us talking on this, you know, we both don't sleep a lot. We would sit out on the, you know, it was June in the Mediterranean. It was beautiful. We would sit on our balcony schmoozing as the sun came up. And so I felt I was changed because of the unique kind of intimacy it gave me with my dad that I know I would not have had otherwise. And I'm very grateful, you know, that he wanted to go on the cruise, which I never thought he would in the first place. So that was changing for me.
So as a consequence of your father auditing your class on the Odyssey, has your teaching of it in subsequent classes changed, and what exactly has changed about it as a result of that experience?
That's a great question. And it did, it has changed. My teaching in general has changed. So what happened was, because my father was so resistant to the charms of the Odyssey and the charms of Odysseus, which no other person is able to resist inside the text and out, so I was saying this before in a humorous way, but it was true. There were these sort of, instead of one authority figure in the classroom, there were two. And that had an effect which I didn't think so much about the time, but have since thought about a lot, which is, so my father became sort of the leader of the opposition, basically, in the classroom. And it was a little, and I talk about this in the book, you know, it was, sometimes it was funny, but sometimes it was a problem, because I had to teach them about the Odyssey, and sometimes his objections were getting in the way of the things I wanted to tell them. But that said, it did occur to me that, again, these are freshmen. They're usually more intimidated than upper class kids, you know. It's different when you're teaching lit majors who are seniors. They've taken 15 literature courses. They're very sophisticated. And I think it emboldened them to be resistant to the professor's ideas, which was very healthy pedagogically. You know, they saw it was possible to not agree with me all the time and to have their own. My father had his own ideas about the Odyssey, and they were his ideas. And I think that was a great example for them. So I think now when I teach, I'm much less invested in being right, to, you know, in a word, to making sure my interpretation is the one that goes down. Look, I'm also, as you know, I'm a critic for a living. I, you know, I'm used to trying to persuade people that my opinions are correct in some way. And it's very healthy, you know, to remember that you don't have to be right all the time. And so I think I listen much harder than I used to my students, and I try to give them more space to just have their own notions. In fact, as you know from reading the book, one of the big climaxes of the book is they had an idea about a certain big moment in the text, which hadn't occurred to me before, and I was very resistant to sort of giving into. And then, you know, and they felt that, and they complained about it, you know, and I thought that was very fruitful. So my father was a kind of lightning rod in a way that proved very beneficial, and which I've tried to internalize ever since. So I do think it changed me as a teacher, actually.
I understand you have four other siblings.
Yes.
Is that right? I'm curious to know how they have reacted to your experience with them and how maybe your relationship has changed with them as a result of this very unique experience mm-hmm. that you had with your father.
Yeah, no, we don't speak anymore. Well, it's a very interesting question. And it's, you know, I, just to call a spade, it's uncomfortable for me. You know, I'm the writer in the family. Well, actually, I have several good, very, very good writers in the family. But, you know, it bothers me. I've talked to all my siblings about this. My older brother, who lives here in the Bay Area, may have been the closest to my father in many ways. I think he appreciated the portrait of my father in this book, possibly more than the others. But it's uncomfortable for me that my version of my father is becoming the version, because none of the other four are going to write their own books, although my brother Matthew is working overtime posting on Facebook to fill in the blanks. So it's a little odd. We don't, you know, anyone who has any siblings knows that every child in a family has a different set of parents. And that's just life. And some of my siblings had more contentious relationships with my father. Some were closer, blah, blah, blah. And so it's, I'm not totally uncomfortable, but there's nothing I can do about it, about the fact that I've written a book, which a lot of people are now reading and discussing and posting about and reviewing. And this Jay Mendelsohn is becoming the Jay Mendelsohn. And that's inevitable, but it's not necessarily right.
You know, it's interesting. I think that's always true with memoir. And even in their minds, I mean, I'm thinking about this incident that happened to my husband, who wrote a short story, who wrote a series of short stories that were about his father. And he was having a conversation with his brother once, and his brother said, "Remember that time Dad and Shell took us to whatever beach?" And Michael shook his head, and he said, "Steve, that I just made that up for a story." And Steve said, "No, I remember it so clearly. We were in the car." I mean, the memory was constructed by my husband in this short story that he wrote. And I think, you know, inevitably that's going to happen with. But you've written about various members of your family in different places and through your memoirs, and I wonder if that's going to, if slowly but surely your siblings will all remember themselves and each other through the Daniel Mendelsohn lens.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think, you know, the point that you're making is a vexatious one if you write anything that's about your family, which is it kind of ossifies a version of events that then starts fossilizing,
mm-hmm.
right? And that actually is very interesting because so most of this book is, you know, or a lot of this book is flashbacks about my childhood, my experience with my father, you know, very specific. But when it was like a facty thing, like I would send email out to all of my siblings, say, "Well, do you remember what Daddy said about when he was in the army?" And everyone would always have a totally different memory, which is not surprising, right? And it's just weird, you know, it's just very weird. But I've talked to all of my siblings about the book and my mother also, who I should say my mother said, this is what my mother said. She said, "What do I have to do to get you to write a book about me? Die?" I said, yes. No, but it's an interesting question. It brings up a lot of strange things, both about families and about writing, you know.
What would your father have thought of this book, and how would it have changed, if at all, your relationship with him? It sounds like it was pretty well developed already.
Well, I mean, I can't know. I have a suspicion, though. When I wrote my first book, which was a memoir, in which about becoming a father myself against expectations. And in that book, I have a lot of flashbacks to my father and what he was like as a father when I was growing up. And they were not always there. I was pretty tough on my father in that book. And when it came out, when I got a finished copy, or I guess when I got the galleys or whatever, I sent it to my parents, and then I stood around the phone biting my nails. And my dad called, and so I said, well, you know, what did you think? And I was very anxious because I was pretty tough. And my father said something that is so touching and so typical of him. And I said, you know, as I said to him, you know, I know there were these things that I'm remembering. He said, it's better to be true than to be flattered.
Aww.
And I thought that was very typical. And I think that's what my, you know, this book, I think, this is a much more developed portrait of my father, and I try to show the things that I thought were wonderful about him. But I'm not holding back on the difficulties we had, and I think he would have liked that. I don't know if he would have liked the book, but I think he would have liked the fact that I'm trying to be truthful to who I thought he was in my life. So
you're much harder on yourself in the book than you are on your father.
Well, I think you have to do that when you're writing memoir.
True.
I think it's something you have to work at, because the impulse to glamorize yourself is so... Look, I mean... It's just natural, even under the guise of being hard on yourself.
Right,
you know, because, of course, now that's a whole...
The humble braggy memoir.
You know, I was so terrible, you know, which, of course, you don't really mean. So, but no, but I think this is the pact you make, which is people read memoir because they want to feel like you're saying true things about the way we live. And... You know, I have a brother who's a filmmaker. It's very interesting. And he always says the most productive emotion in art is shame. And I always think that's so brilliant. And it's very hard to write about things that you're really embarrassed about rather than the things you pretend bother you. It's like, oh, my addictions, you know.
Right.
You know, but I mean, the stuff that's really, you know, that makes you wince 50 years later that you still can't, you know, that's hard, but that's why they're reading it.
Right.
If you can talk about that stuff and not glamorize it, that's the bargain you're making. But it's harder, but it's, you know, that's why you do it. It's easy to be hard on other people, you know. So it's good to try, you know.
This is a bit off subject, but I'm curious whether when you came out to your father, when you, you know, had to deal with being gay and you related to him that, how that changed your relationship, whether there was a time when you could see the effect of that information on him, and whether at certain points that could have brought you closer together.
Well, it's a good question, and in fact, there's a major part of the book which is about my coming out to my father, who was, to me, unexpectedly wonderful and gentle when I did come out. The famous story about my coming out, which took place when I was in my junior year of college in 1887, And I was home on spring break, and our across the street neighbor got engaged, and so we went to the engagement party, and we were coming back into our house, and I had been rehearsing for weeks, and I had a whole speech this whole Ciceronian speech in five parts. And I said, there's something I have to... Because my father said, we were coming in the door. I remember he had his hand on the door. He said, are you dating anyone? Like, you know, I said, something I have to talk to you about. And he said, I said, it's very important. And they said, all right, we'll come up into the bedroom. It was all the important conversation. So my parents sat on their bed, and I sat on the floor, and I started the speech. And within 4 seconds, I heard snoring. My mother had fallen asleep. My father actually was very funny. He had a very dry sense of humor. He nudges my mother, and he said, Marlene, he said, don't you think you should be, like, sticking your head in the oven or something? And my father was very funny, and he said something. He said, let me talk to Daniel. I know something about this. And I'm not telling you the rest of this story because then you won't buy the book. But it was actually on the cruise when he told me the rest of that story, where I was so embarrassed by the idea that my father would have some knowledge of anything like this that I never pursued it at the time. But the whole story comes out on the cruise, actually, as a result of this funny chain of events. So he was actually very wonderful, but was never a problem. And this was, all kidding aside, this was 1979. And I had friends that I went to high school with who, as I later found out, because of course we didn't know that each other was gay because nobody talked about it, but they were thrown out of the house. These were upper middle class Jewish lawyers, you know. So I've never stopped being grateful to my parents because it was such a non-issue for them. And I think it just spared me an incredible amount of torture that I know a lot of other people went through. And that was my dad. You know, so that's what I mean. You see, I can react in a certain way because I knew my father, and I knew that there was this other side to him that was the flip side of the gruff pushiness, you know, and that, so he was complicated, but who isn't?
So I'm going to end it here on that note because I'm going to make a little pitch here. First of all, for those of you who haven't read The Odyssey or are not going to read The Odyssey, you will be able to talk at cocktail parties till the end of time about The Odyssey. I'm so smart about The Odyssey now. It's incredible. And unless I take Daniel's class, I will not read it. And with that, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much,
Thanks,
Daniel.
Anne.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn, whose new memoir is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. He was joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.